Welcome to the 2010 Pilot Peer-to-Peer Dialogue. This educational activity is sponsored by the France Foundation and is supported by an educational grant from Intermune. CME information can be found at the website www.pilotforipf.org. Dialogue 3 is eligible for CME credit from November 2010 through November 30th, 2011. Today, Drs. Padilla, San, and Strange will discuss the following. Which CTD should be included in a differential diagnosis of progressive dyspnea and restrictive lung disease? Let's listen in.
When we see patients and we're considering interstitial lung disease might be the disease they're presenting with, we always want to know whether we're dealing with a disease such as idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, or is this interstitial lung disease associated with a connective tissue disease. For example, if we see a young woman in her 40s who's never smoked, IPF would not be highest on my differential diagnosis. However, if the patient comes in with dyspnea, pleuritic chest pain, Raynaud's phenomenon, or things that would suggest an autoimmune disease, then we might take a different diagnostic pathway.
Steve, you know, the piece that makes me think about the connective tissue diseases here are the more specific presentations that some of them have. So I'm particularly interested in Raynaud's that's present in about 80% of these individuals. And it really makes me go to the bedside and look very carefully at the physical exam, particularly at skin and joints. Skin, we're looking for cracked fingers, suggestive of mechanics, hands, erythema and a malar rash associated with lupus, or the myositis presentations of dermatomyositis and Schall signs and heliotrope rashes.
Quite agree with both of you that those are tip-offs that we should be looking for another associated illness with the interstitial lung disease. But you also have to include in those patients who are lacking some of these manifestations, particularly at the beginning of their illness, and then only develop it as the disease progresses. So one has to keep a very high index of suspicion with any ILD that comes in through the door. But as you pointed out, these particular physical findings or complaints should raise our desire to pursue this diagnosis a little bit further.
Well, let's take people who you know have a connective tissue disease, such as rheumatoid arthritis, and they have no respiratory complaints. Charlie or Marie, do you follow these people with physiologic studies, maybe looking for early onset of ILD?
Rheumatoid is the hardest example of all of these to follow.
That's why I gave it to you, Charlie.
I know. But the answer is yes in scleroderma because the frequency of interstitial lung disease is so high. And the frequency in rheumatoid is so variable depending upon which modality you choose to screen these individuals with. For instance, on spirometry, less than 20% of these will develop physiologically significant restriction. But if you do high-res CT, they're going to have a very high frequency of abnormalities. So I don't routinely screen my rheumatoids, but I do screen my myositis patients, my sclerodermas, and so I think there is a difference in hierarchy between the different connective tissue diseases that unfortunately means we need to learn each of these connective tissue diseases as a separate entity. Marie, what do you think?
I agree. I think that screening some of these specific diseases is worthwhile. You may pick up the patient even before they have obvious clinical signs, or there is an obvious CT scan to go with them, performing spirometries, performing the diffusing capacities on a periodic interval, perhaps yearly or something. Is the frequency is yet to be determined. You know, the echocardiogram becomes an important aspect of things to monitor in certain diseases such as scleroderma in those patients because they do develop pulmonary hypertension. Just like they do develop pulmonary hypertension, they will develop the interstitial lung disease, I would say, in a good 15-20% of these patients that have an underlying connective tissue disorder.
Sometimes it's a problem because we don't get to follow patients with rheumatoid arthritis, so we have to educate our colleagues in rheumatology that that might be a good idea to follow some of their physiologic parameters.
We're blessed in Charleston to actually have our clinic in the same clinic as that with the rheumatologists, and so we frequently can share these patients and bounce them off each other and find real value in that. And so for any of our listeners that can develop a rheumatologist to work with on some of these hard cases, it really makes a difference. Maria, you said something a minute ago that I really wanted to pick up on, which was the presentation of someone that you're convinced has IPF, who a year down the road or 2 years down the road starts developing some subtle signs of connective tissue diseases. And the one I find the hardest is the swallowing abnormality, knowing that we have some frequency of gastroesophageal reflux and IPF. What do you do to further define if there is an esophageal dysmotility part that's the early sign of a connective tissue disease?
We have been looking at these patients and even actually doing pH probes and doing motility studies on their esophagus to try to discern the patient who has this problem associated with their underlying disease. And often it is seen in those patients who have a mild elevation in the ANA or may have a scleral-70 positivity or an anti-centromere positivity without classical signs of scleroderma or dermatomyositis, and they may have an anti-JO1 positivity or any of the anti-synthetases. So that we tend to be very aggressive when it comes to the esophagus and looking for these motility dysfunction.
Yeah, sometimes on the CT scan you'll see a dilated esophagus.
Exactly.
With a UIP picture, and there you go.
Yeah. So that's another tip-off, and I think that looking at not only the parenchyma, but looking at the vasculature for that pulmonary artery that is markedly enlarged or disproportionately enlarged, more than you would expect, and looking at the esophagus, as well as sometimes looking at the lymph nodes to see if there is any immunologic hyperactivity in those lymph nodes are important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like looking at the lungs myself, and so what tip-offs do y'all have that this might be a connective tissue disease just on the basis of lung parenchyma analysis?
Well, for one thing, is the I've been struck by asymmetry in some of these patients. They're asymmetrical in their development of disease, but certainly the presence of more ground glass than you would expect raises that question. You do have cystic formation, but it's not true honeycombing. You may have even a little bit of a pleural reaction or a pleural effusion, which should tip you off that you're not dealing with UIP. How about you, Steve?
And rheumatoid is a classic example. Mm-hmm. The pleura is interesting. The pleura is normal in IPF. The mesothelial cells are normal. You don't get pleural fibrosis. You can see a basement membrane. But particularly in rheumatoid disease, and less commonly in scleroderma, you will see that. And again, I haven't found the asymmetry to be particularly helpful in this. I mean, most of the time it's a homogeneous disease. It is NSIP, and it is basal predominant. But sometimes there is that sparing you see between the lung edge and the chest wall.
So the disease, nonspecific interstitial pneumonitis, or NSIP, as y'all realize, is the most common presentation of all the interstitial lung diseases in the connective tissue diseases, with the exception of rheumatoid, where usual interstitial pneumonitis, or UIP, presents as the pathologic entity most often identified at a rate of about 80%. So do you think we should biopsy those rheumatoid patients and figure out if there's a difference in survival?
No. It would be interesting, but I wouldn't want to put these patients through that, Charlie. And I think we can make a reasonable, confident clinical diagnosis without resorting to surgical lung biopsy.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is one of those diagnoses that I turn to serology to really define whether I go down that pathway of open lung biopsy or not. And so We have some emerging statements that are coming out about how to manage idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, but I think among the most controversial statements are exactly which serologies should each of us get at presentation of an interstitial lung disease. Maria, what do you do?
Yeah. Well, you both know my bias when it comes to this, and I do respect the SED rating, which is an old test and very inexpensive to kind of discriminate some of the patients who have immunologic.
It certainly can be, I do get that routinely.
Yeah.
It certainly can be a signal to move further.
Forward, right. So, but it has to be a respectable SED rate. It's not going to be a 20-30. It's going to be an 80 to 110, 120.
Right, it's got to be a high SED rate.
A high SED rate. And then the panel that we utilize includes ANAs, includes the anti-JO1, includes sclera 70, includes anti-centromere. The anti-synthetase panel that we do, the anti-Ro and anti-La, looking for Sjogren's, and those patients, particularly in those who have some Sicca syndrome, and more often they have eye or mouth or both of them that complain of being dry. So
some of our listeners will have different panels at their hospital. Let's make sure we all classify each of these carefully. So the anti-nuclear antibody, or ANA, is one available everywhere.
Correct.
And we know that that one increases in positivity as we age, and the worry about this one in the IPF population has been recorded to be positive at up to 20% of the elderly population. Steve, what do you do about ANAs with or without the specific patterns associated with them?
Well, I do order an ANA routinely, but I don't get excited until the titer is 1 to 160 or 1 to 320. I think the anamyositis panel has been surprising at times on patients, but we've been seeing these weekly positive, not JO1s, but PL12, PL7, and KUs, and I really don't know clinically what to make of these.
Maria, what do you think about ANAs in this population? Are they a good screening test?
I do think that they are a good screening test. I think that, as we referred to it before, the actual titer and the level of it has to be taken into account because of just what you mentioned before in the process of aging that will affect this this level. But certainly there are patterns within this ANA that will help you discriminate some of the patients. We have the topoisomerases, which is, or the sclera 70 pattern, that is highly associated with interstitial lung disease in patients who do have it, may or may not have a prognostic value in this population, but we can talk about that later. And the other pattern is that of the anti-centromere, that when we see that, we think more of a limited or a variant of scleroderma that is associated with higher frequency of vascular disease, with pulmonary hypertension, and kind of pushes you to look more for that underlying complication or comorbidity in this disease. But even in those patients, you can see some interstitial lung disease, so that these patterns become important in this regard.
You know, the way I do that, Maria, is I look for that titer of ANA at least to be 160 before I send out my extractable nuclear antigen panel, or ENA panel, and most hospitals have these available to them. And these are other autoantibodies that will almost always have an ANA positivity associated with them, and these include our scleroderma-associated antibodies, SSA and SSB, ribonucleoprotein, RNP, JO1 antibody, and we find all of those particularly helpful if we can identify a moderate titer signal there, because each of those then is a responsive entity to prednisone and will lead us into the situation where we really don't need an open lung biopsy to make this diagnosis. Steve, what do you do when these autoantibody signals are of very low signal?
Well, that's a good question, Charlie. I mean, I'm not sure what they mean. We've seen a number of these studies come back weakly positive, not the Jo-1, but some of the lesser known antimyositis antibody panels, PL-12, PL-7, and KU. We found in the PL-12 series that we did that the pathology in all of these patients was UIP. And again, this was a study done at four different centers, so variability as far as treatment, but really no effect of treatment in these patients.
So we also see UIP histology in rheumatoid pretty frequently, and I guess the whole question then is, should we be doing open lung biopsies? I guess we already talked about that one, didn't we?
Yeah.
I guess
the answer is still no.
The answer is still no. We went backwards on that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's okay.
We also should not forget to include here is the amyopathic interstitial lung disease that is associated with some of the antisynthetases. And they have been looked at, and they have been a little bit more responsive than our idiopathic counterparts when it comes to the various histologies that we see there.
I've always found that the amyopathic dermatomyositis is a very hard diagnosis to make, and many of our patients have seen dermatologists more than once to try and figure out what their skin rash is. So I think this is one of those situations where the pulmonologist can look at the skin rash and almost put the disease together if they have mechanics hands or a more classic presentation, and really instruct and work along with your dermatologist to tell them that this is the real disease that they're treating. And importantly, that's typically a pretty responsive diagnosis.
But I worry more about those that we don't have a classical presentation as such, and we don't find those findings, or they develop subsequently.
So you believe that all NSIP is just a connective tissue disease for which we've not found the appropriate serology yet?
Well, we didn't have antisynthetases before. We just had anti-Jo-1. And so now that we have antisynthetases, we have just expanded that group of patients that we call NSIP.
Yeah, I'm particularly impressed with the Hopkins group that keeps describing a new anti-synthetase antibody every year, and we still got some more to go, I think. So we wonder if that isn't the truth.
Yes.
This is the first of three discussions for Pilot Peer-to-Peer Dialogue number 3. We would like to thank Drs. Padilla, Son, and Strange for their contributions and continued support. Thank you for listening. To receive credit, please complete the attestation evaluation form.